What is it called? A well. Like you'd lost someone down. Hello, and welcome to Down Not Out, a podcast about depression and anxiety with me, Paddy.
And me, Will. I'm still looking down that well.
Looking for a lost...
I've sounded a little bit too jolly to be looking down a well, to be honest, didn't I? Hello.
Someone you're really pleased to have got rid of. Got rid of, should I say.
Hello, welcome. We've got a great guest for you this week. But before we do that, we've got a couple of things to talk about, haven't we?
We have got a few things to talk about. I think the first of which is some paint that your body has acquired.
And yes, Paddy would like me to mention this. I had got a tattoo 2 weeks ago, which was... it's not a massive deal in the sense that I've got other ones.
Where is it, Will?
It's on my chest.
Ew.
Yes, on my chest. And it was very sore, indeed. But... yeah, worth it. Worth it. It was a fun experience, and it's one that means quite a lot to me. So, I'm happy with it. We're at the stage now where it's pretty much healed, so the annoying stage is over.
Tell us about the tattoo, Will.
It's a Spitfire, but it's specifically a sort of copy of a painting of the plane that my grandfather flew in World War II. So yeah, really, and he died a couple of years ago. So. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
cool. And it has your and his initials on the Spitfire, which
it does,
fortunately
yeah.
are the same.
His name is Will Lynn as well. Well, everyone called him Bill, but his name
Bill
was,
Lynn.
His name was his name.
Everyone
was,
might start calling you Bill now.
Everyone might start calling me Bill. I feel like that's like you're over 40 when you call Bill.
Okay.
You know.
Well, sorry to all those under 40 Bills out there.
you're weird.
Absolutely savage. So cool. So you've done that, which is very... I'm not going to lie, when you first told me about that, I thought it was a dreadful idea, and I've seen it. And I still... No, I'm joking. I really like it. It's really cool. And it's much smaller than I thought as well, because I was slightly... worried that it was going to be taking up your entire chest.
Yeah, no, it's definitely quite diddy. It's as diddy as you could have done it without sacrificing detail, you know.
Yeah, and so what's been going on apart from that?
I've been to spa this weekend as well, which has been lovely.
That's an absolute sort of lady of luxury.
I really am. I'm a lady who lunches.
You're a lady who lunches at the spa at the weekend. Spa. Lovely.
Yeah, the sad thing about the spa was that I couldn't go into the like pools because of the tattoo, which is a shame because the pools are the best thing about any spa.
Their legislation, I hope.
No, that's me looking. You can do what you want.
Tell you what, my type of spa, you wouldn't be allowed in.
In regardless of the front door.
Regardless of whether it's recovered or not.
With that ink. But yeah, I had a massage, which was very nice, and had a facial. So, I feel revised.
What is a facial?
It's, you like, essentially get like your skin exfoliated and moisturised and like different ointments put on it. And you clearly tell, you know. I can see you looking, wow, that complexion is next level.
Rosy
yeah.
and glowing.
Exactly. But yeah, that was really lovely. What about you, Paddy? What have you been up to?
I haven't had a facial.
Haven't had a facial.
And dare I say it, that might be showing as well.
Absolutely not.
My beloved Ipswich Town have been relegated.
Ah, that's a shame. That is a real shame.
That wasn't said with too much sincerity.
Was that expected?
The lack of sincerity or the relegation?
Lack of sincerity was obviously expected.
Yeah. The relegation was as expected as the lack of sincerity.
Okay.
So that has...
That's tough.
That's been tough.
Yeah. But you've been comforted by the fact that there's been a video circulating of Leeds manager Marco Bielsa trying to say Ipswich.
Yes, trying to say Ipswich,
is,
yeah.
It's an extraordinarily difficult word, I think, for somebody who doesn't speak English as a native language to say.
Well, also, Perhaps, but never has a man made it look more difficult.
He just gives up to be fair to him. Valiantly, he just says, you know what, I'm making a meal of this. So, but yeah.
A valiant surrendering.
Valiant surrender. Such a thing exists. It really does, I think. It really does. Something Theresa May should be looking to do. Political.
Very political. Well, very political for an impartial broadcaster.
Yeah.
So this week on the pod, we spoke to Jamie, who's a friend and colleague of mine. And he was really fantastic, and I hope everyone listening really enjoys it. It was particularly relevant for me because we talk a lot about the struggles with sexuality, and it's just, yeah, it was really, really interesting and really brave of Jamie to talk about, so I'm very glad that he has. And on that topic, just before we sort of start, I think we want to just talk about a couple of things, don't we? It seems fitting as, well, seeing as we're talking about the sort of LGBT community and then also journalism, seems fitting that we should mention Lyra McKee, the Northern Irish journalist who was very sadly killed recently. And I don't think we want to go into a huge amount of detail in the issues surrounding the death and what's going on in Ireland at the moment politically, because that's a complicated topic for another podcast that I certainly don't have the knowledge to start right now. But we just watched a TED talk that Lyra McKee did in Stormont, I don't know when, a few years ago, I think. And I found it really moving.
Yeah, so did I. I absolutely agree on that point. And I, you know, obviously I think like a lot of people, when I heard the news of her death, I didn't know who she was. But I obviously, they said she was a journalist and she'd been involved in the LGBT campaigns, but I had never seen anything that she'd done. So you just showed me that video. Yeah, it was a fantastic speech and really, really, really powerful.
So just some of the top lines of it, I guess, and I would highly recommend anyone to watch it because it's only about 10 minutes long. But she talks about her experience being sent out to America to do some research and also sort of diplomacy, I guess, with looking into groups of varying different beliefs from people like the NRA, National Rifle Association, to Christian groups, to all sorts of different groups who may or may not share beliefs, and in fact their views may stand starkly in contrast to one another. And the most, I guess the point that resonated with me the most was when she talks about her trip to a mosque in Orlando. Orlando being the scene where, or the scene of a nightclub terrorist attack in which just under 50 people were killed in a gay club in Orlando. She went to speak to people in the local mosque, and this was quite nerve-wracking for her because she says that she had been brought up in a very religious society, and she says, I hated myself for much of my life for what religion taught me about people like me. And when I stopped hating myself, I started hating religion. So it was a very difficult place for her to go in the wake of such a horrendous
act of terror.
Horrendous act of terror, yeah. And she goes to visit the mosque and she's chatting to someone from the mosque about herself and her sexuality, and she does state that the mosque had actually come out and been very, very supportive of those who had been killed in this attack. And as she was chatting to someone in the mosque, another man came up and said, my best friend was gay, he was Muslim, and he committed suicide because he couldn't live with himself for his sexuality. And it's very moving, and they all start crying. And I guess the main point from her talk is seeing her transition in herself from being someone who felt hated by religion to being someone who felt that she hated religion, to now being someone who recognizes that there just needs to be a conversation. And this is the key point of her talk. She just says there's no point standing in opposition to one another. There's no point screaming bigots at people who are of who have strong religious beliefs. The only way to move forward is to not berate Muslims, Christians, whatever religion people are, but to have difficult conversations and fight for the hearts and minds of those people. And this comes up actually to a lesser degree in the talk that we had with Jamie. But what she says is everyone she spoke to who used to be a strong, who used to have strong, let's say, anti-gay beliefs or strong anti-something beliefs, in every single case, what made them change their mind was a conversation. This applies to so much that's going on in the world right now, I think, is that just shouting at someone and telling them they're a bigot, they're an idiot, they don't get it, is never ever going to get anyone to change their mind about anything.
Political.
Yeah. Stick to your fucking point, Williams.
No, you're right. You're right. People are never going to, you know, change their mind if they feel stupid.
Yeah.
If you make somebody feel stupid by saying you are just wrong about this, and I don't understand, there's no reason for you to think the way that you do, then, you know, people aren't going to be susceptible to being moulded in any way, or to not being moulded, sorry, to be changed in any way by any differing views.
Yeah. So that was a really cool talk, and I would just recommend that you watch it, because we haven't really been able to do it much justice.
So, moving on to our guest for today, Paddy, you know him a lot better than I do, so I'm going to let you introduce him and what we should expect.
Great, thank you, Will. Yeah, so our guest today is Jamie, who is a friend and colleague of mine. He is a fantastic journalist, and we were delighted when he agreed to speak on the pod. He, in fact, got in touch after our first episode, completely out of the blue, to say how much he enjoyed it, which we really, really appreciated. And it was really great to have him on. He speaks really frankly about some really personal issues, and we really hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So today we are here with Jamie. Hello, Jamie.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on. So, Jamie, can you just give us a bit of a background as to why you are here and what you told us in your bio?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've never really discussed it in detail before, kind of everything I went through, but it's fairly recent for me where it kind of all came out in quite a lot of ways. So I got back from Washington in April 2017. I was there for nearly a year for work, following Donald Trump around. And then wasn't really feeling myself, kind of felt very low mood, wasn't really, you know, felt very withdrawn from family and friends, and just threw myself into work, which is kind of a common theme here. But then I got sent sort of in the early hours after the Manchester attack up to Manchester to cover the story. And I was there for sort of nearly 2 weeks and just found the whole experience just quite tough, around grief all the time. You know, it was obviously one of the most worst stories in recent years here. And it just kind of reached crisis point. And one day I just couldn't leave my hotel room. I called my colleague and just said, I do not feel in a safe place to leave this hotel room. And, you know, that same day I was back, and a couple of days later I was in hospital. So it was kind of a, wow, this has gone from one extreme to the other quite rapidly. Yeah, so I eventually got back and was diagnosed with sort of severe depression with a bit of PTSD in there for the mix.
So, I mean, there's a huge amount of interesting stuff to talk about here. I guess the first question for me is, what was it that you were feeling inside that hotel room when you couldn't leave? And what was it that you had seen in Manchester? Had you seen bodies? What had you seen?
Yeah. I mean, no, I hadn't seen bodies. You know, I got up there sort of at 6, 7 o'clock the next morning. So it wasn't like the gore of it. It was the grief and human sort of outpouring of, you know, this devastation of this area. And I was around grief for sort of nearly 2 weeks straight, whether it be listening to parents who just lost kids being interviewed, you know, I was around St. Anne's Square where they just, everyone came to lay flowers and teddies and everything. And just speaking to people who saw what had happened and has helped in the aftermath. And I just could not sort of process that. And it was just the real darkness of the worst thing to have happened to someone. And I felt a bit afterwards, kind of, I felt sort of shame because I felt, God, you know, who gets PTSD by just sort of covering a story? You know, that's like we sort of discussed before, it's a Marine Army thing, isn't it? It's not, it's people who go to war and see bodies and kill people, not a journalist who goes to cover a terrorist attack. But that's kind of what happened.
So would you mind just explaining what PTSD is? Because I think it's a term that we've all heard a lot, but maybe don't actually know what it is.
Yeah, well, I'll try my best. But so post-traumatic stress disorder, it kind of affects people who have seen something very traumatic or experienced something, whether that, you know, it could be the loss of a relative, or it could be, you know, like we mentioned, front line of a war or a terrorist attack. Anything like that, something that they cannot process and still sort of lives with them.
And is it kind of night terrors? Is it how does it manifest itself?
For me, it manifests itself with I could not think about anything else. The worst bit about it was the sleep. I couldn't sleep, and then when I did sleep, I was having vivid dreams about it. So one recurring dream I had was I was back in Manchester and all my colleagues were dead at the train station, and I was having to walk over bodies and things like that. So it was just like, it always came back to what had happened.
I think what we said this earlier, but it's a really interesting point. You hear the term PTSD is almost synonymous with people serving in the armed forces or have seen active frontline service, because you sort of think there's sort of an idea that the only thing that's traumatic enough to give you that sort of prolonged aftermath is war.
Yeah.
But that's absolutely not the case. Anything really, it depends on the person, but anything really, and I think that would absolutely be the case with you, that you've seen something or been in an area after something's happened that is so horrible that it just affected you so badly.
Yeah, and I think for me, I was just consumed by the darkness of it. Of, you know, most evil act, and then to be around people who are dealing with the repercussions of that, whether they knew someone or they'd lost someone. And I remember one thing that I couldn't get out of my head was I was around when the family of one girl, I think her name was Georgina Callender, her family came to lay flowers at St. Anne's Square, and then they did this kind of tour of all the flowers, and the other side of the rope line was this mum hugging her kids, crying her eyes out. And the dad just turned to her and said, look after them because you never know. And he just took time out of, you know. And I was with the police liaison officer, and I just couldn't get that out of my head afterwards.
And I guess as a journalist, the tricky thing here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that your job is to be there and to do your job.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be, you know, almost, you've got to be neutral, really, you know, but you can't get too emotionally involved. And I just found that incredibly difficult not to. And I know a lot of my colleagues did as well. You know, it's, some of them were from Manchester or nearby, you know, they'd gone out in Manchester. They could relate to this story.
Yeah.
And I think that was the biggest thing, just the human grief up front. And when you're feeling slightly shit about yourself anyway, it just compounds that and you think, God, what's the point almost?
Yeah. So you just mentioned there that you had been feeling slightly shit beforehand. So that kind of suggests that there were some issues in the background that perhaps had been brought to the foreground by this experience. Would you mind just explaining a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Manchester wasn't the sole cause of why you know, why I was unwell. You know, it was a big factor, but I describe it as kind of the train wreck that brought out this kind of eruption of emotions, really. Before that, I realised how unwell I'd been feeling going into Manchester. I just had no, I was withdrawn, I just wasn't happy, I was, you know, felt very distant from family and friends, and I just kind of attributed it to coming back from Washington, where I'd been for over a year, and it felt like a bit final in the end of it, but actually it felt something else, sort of quite deep going on.
Would you sort of maybe describe Manchester as like the straw that broke the camel's back?
Exactly that.
So you were like, maybe, I wouldn't want to say, you were sort of like repressing it and just sort of trying to get on with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, Will's never that far away from a cliche, also, can I say? You said that as though it was like the most philosophical new phrase that you might not have heard before.
Guys, let me know you've heard this one. Yeah, yeah, no, that's right.
So yeah, exactly that, to use that cliche. Straw that broke the camel's back. And just, yeah, there's only so many kind of, to use another one, sort of sticking plasters that you can put on before that wound needs to be properly treated.
So what were the wounds?
I'd say the biggest thing was kind of accepting myself for who I was. I worried far too much about what people thought of me. Wasn't comfortable in my own skin, and my reaction or the way of coping with that was to just throw everything into work, and that's what I'd done. You know, I started in my newsroom when I was 18, and even then felt there was this thing bubbling away, but I just needed to, always wanted to be a journalist, so you know what, I've got a chance at a massive company. So let's just throw everything into that.
Sorry, just to interrupt, but what was bubbling away?
I would say, I mean, my main thing for me is sort of sexuality.
Yeah.
I can just about say it now, I'm bisexual.
Yeah.
So accepting the fact that I liked guys and girls. I didn't feel where I sort of grew up, where I went to school, that was particularly accepted. So I just felt this shame and this kind of stigma around it, and I just felt I hated myself for it.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I just, in those years, threw myself into work and didn't properly confront the problem.
Did you like accept the sexuality? Did you like say, okay, I am bisexual and I just hate that? Or did you try to sort of say, no, I'm straight and just...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just try to suppress it and try to, you know, go and get with loads of girls and just pretend it was all fine, and it wasn't, and it kind of all came out when kind of one of my close mates, who I had kind of confided in and we were good mates, you know, I fell for him and he didn't take that very well, and between us we didn't exactly cope with the fallout of it well. And that's when I thought, wow, okay, this isn't just a phase, I suppose, for the want of a better term, but it was something that I needed to deal with, but I just wasn't, I don't feel I had the tools to deal with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, man, it's really brave of you to talk about this, and I relate to it massively. I mean, it's almost weirdly similar, you know, for me, having... Yeah, I struggled. Well, yeah, I've struggled massively with my sexuality, and I've fallen for, I mean, more than one friend of mine. And it's really, really, it's so tricky. And I think if you have, I think, you know, people massively underestimate how difficult it is to come out still. And part of what we were talking about before is so much of it is actually about self-acceptance. Society does now is far more accepting, probably not as accepting as people think, especially if you live in like a big city and you you know, read The Guardian and, you know, you probably think it's easier than it is. But I think self-acceptance is massive. For me, that was definitely the biggest challenge. And I say that as though it's a thing of the past. It's not. Like, it's still an ongoing challenge to, to accept yourself, because it's certainly not an image of who I thought I was. And that, for me, that's so big. I had always just... It had never even crossed my mind prior to probably my early 20s, which is very late, I know, for a lot of people, but, you know, everyone develops and learns at different stages in their lives. And it comes as a massive shock to you. And, yeah, I just felt huge amounts of guilt and shame and confusion.
Yeah, and that... I mean, we're singing from the same...
Yeah.
It's exactly... it's a day of clichés.
I was going to say,
cliché bingo. But, yeah, it's that guilt and shame. And I felt... The word that sticks out for me is I felt tainted.
Oh, interesting.
And felt, you know... So I think we are fed this image. I hope the kind of the next generation and, you know, my friends' kids don't sort of... I think it'll be hopefully far easier for them in terms of society and what they watch on telly and read in the papers, that sort of thing. But for me, it was just that shame and that guilt, and it didn't... I'm sort of a perfectionist. I want things to be exactly how I, you know, want them to go, whether it be my job or friends or, you know... And it came down to that I wanted to be... It's going to sound awful, and I hate this term, but normal. What I considered normal.
Yes, 100%.
And I wasn't.
Yeah.
Like that. And that's something, and you know, when I confided in a couple of friends, you know, I'd looking back now, I'd felt this through school, but kept suppressing it. And then obviously it came out with that friend. And then the rejection of that and the fallout of that sort of only compounded the feeling that there was something wrong with me, and I wasn't ever going to be able to accept this or live a full and happy life. And then, you know, you go and cover something like Manchester and you think, well, you feel shit and, you know, you're going to lose someone you love anyway. So it all filtered and became just kind of this toxic mix that was inevitably going to kind of send me crashing.
We wanted to touch on as well, you've mentioned it before, is throwing yourself into work. You started at your job when you were 18, which is quite rare these days, not to go straight into a job. So I'm assuming it was like a traineeship or something like that.
Yeah, it was an apprenticeship,
So it was like you were in a big dream company pretty young. So you had that sort of drive to, I need to just make the most of this, and sort of just buried other things. But if that's pretty... damaging, I think you probably...
Massively. And I think the adrenaline of that kind of kept me going for a while. But you can't put all your eggs in one basket. And when you hit...
Ding!
There's another one.
Yeah. It's a full house for Jamie!
And when you, you know, when something kind of wrongly... sort of separate things, you've got friends and family, you've got work, and you've got kind of your own identity, I think, and you can't have just throw everything into one, because, you know, if that fucks up, which it did for me here, then you feel exposed, and it's not a healthy thing to do. So when I reflect back, I wish I'd got help far earlier to talk about these things, because it's just not... it's not sustainable.
Did you ever get any help prior to Manchester?
During school, I was... I struggled with the pressure of kind of exams. And I mean, it all goes back to what I was dealing with sexuality-wise, but I just pinned it on something else. So I became quite obsessive around exams. And I know you've spoken before in my previous podcast, like rituals and, you know... So I had a little bit of kind of CBT for that. But nothing that went to the kind of root of the problem. It was just kind of sticking plasters again.
Yeah.
So when your sort of friends and family find out about you sort of struggling, how did they deal with it, and was there differences between different people as in how they sort of processed it?
Yeah, I think a lot of that also came from me in terms of the people that I pushed away and the people that I let in. I'd say I didn't want anything to do with family at that point. I just completely pushed them away.
Sorry, is this straight after Manchester?
Yeah. Just couldn't open up to them. I couldn't even look at them. I couldn't talk to them. And it was weird how it manifested itself in almost like a physical manner. I became a bit of a mute and just didn't open up, or couldn't even, yeah, like I said, couldn't even engage in small talk.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I still can't. I think everything around me felt so fragile after sort of covering a story like that, that it just felt, I was terrified of something else happening like that. And I think any kind of engaging with anyone that you, nearest and dearest, felt a risk, if that makes sense.
And because you were living with them at the time, right? So how was that?
Tricky. I sort of moved out of my mum and dad's for a bit and went to my nan's, who's only around the corner, just for a bit of space. But even now, I couldn't talk to anyone. I was just so consumed by my own thoughts that it just wasn't working. And I relied on a very kind of small group of sort of four people who knew what was going on, who I felt able to say, I'm in a really dark place in a really bad way. And that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Do you want to just tell us a bit about the people that you could confide in and how important that was, and your relationship with them? Were they friends? Are they colleagues?
They were close colleagues and friends. One of them who brought me back, and then one of my friends who's also kind of my boss, who helped me access the care that I needed at that point. And I really leant on them for months and months and months, just not confided in them, and just said, I don't know how to, everything was so dark, and so I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. So it was almost that constant reassurance I needed from them that it would get better and I would feel more like my old self again. But I was able to do that with them, but not others, which I still find a bit weird. So sort of parents and some of my oldest school friends just wasn't able to articulate what I was going through. Perhaps it was because friends I did rely on, they're a bit older, so could have a bit more of a mature perspective, I suppose.
Yeah. Is there something about a bit more distance as well that can actually be helpful at times? So someone who you've grown up with your whole life, be it family or friends that you've known since X, it's almost too close.
I think so. Whereas, friends who I'd met kind of a couple of years before, while we were close, it wasn't, I don't know, I guess there wasn't as much shame there. And I think that's a big thing with when people are so low and so dark, that sense of shame at feeling like you're giving up, which I was at that point.
So you mentioned that someone at work took you to get the treatment that you required. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, my friend Matt sort of helped me, who I'd lived with in Washington when I was based there with him and his family, and we became quite close, and he helped me work, had private healthcare. So when I came back from Manchester, he helped me facilitate that. And I ended up going to sort of an inpatient unit, paid for privately, which I was obviously very fortunate, because I needed really urgent help. And I think without having that, it could be a very different story. So that I was able to access an inpatient unit, I then had, just to get me sort of in a bit more of a stable place, and then I had sort of specialist PTSD therapy, and then I still see a brilliant therapist called Louis, who I think kind of saved me, really. But I'm very, very fortunate and very grateful for the fact that I had that access, and a lot of people don't.
And I think if I'd had to rely on a NHS route, I think it would have been a far more challenging and long journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point that you make. I mean, certainly when I was suffering with my depression, I remember I went to I was really, really, really struggling, and I went to the doctor and they recommended me getting CBT, and I got back a letter about a week later saying that you could have an appointment in 8 weeks' time. And I just remember thinking at that time, I just kind of remember sitting on the loo in my flat, just like head in my hands, totally despairing, because I was like, I can't wait eight weeks. And this is not to criticize the system, but it's just like, there was absolutely no way I could have waited 8 weeks. And so that then pushed me to go and just like break down in front of the GP and then get the sort of necessary help, that which was in my case medication. But yeah, it is so tricky, isn't it? Because obviously it is a service which is in much demand and underfunded, but it can definitely cost lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I find it so infuriating, and because if you're in that much physical pain, it wouldn't be acceptable. So why, when someone is at such a low ebb where, you know, it's life or death in those moments, I think, why is that acceptable to think, well, you can wait 8 weeks to, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, it just infuriates me.
The demand is getting greater, but the response, I think, from providers hasn't been quick enough. But yeah, I was lucky like you. I had sort of private healthcare through my parents, so I was seen straight away. But I had a friend who was quite clearly having a breakdown.
Yeah.
To everybody around him, it was obvious he was having a breakdown, and it took him to like bypass the system.
Yeah.
He had to like essentially have a psychotic episode, strip naked and ran through a hospital. Yeah. And before this, he was just literally just going into the hospitals and like to appointments and telling the doctors, I feel terrible. And they just were like, eight weeks.
Yeah.
You'll see someone 8 weeks.
And it just shouldn't have to be like that. And, you know, I now go to check in with kind of local GP, NHS GP, to sort of medication and things, and you know, I remember one time that I was in a really bad way and I needed to see her, and I had to break down at the reception desk because I was just, they were like, nope, sorry, no more appointments for 2 weeks. And I was like, you don't realise how urgent this is. So the system just isn't set up to cope, and you know, politicians bang on about parity between mental and physical health, and we are, you know, leagues away from that. When I see posters up around, you know, GPs about mental health and hospitals, like, you know, get help, you know, I think, well, it's all very well saying that, but you need to actually make the help, have it there. You know, you can't scream about people need to talk, but you need to give them the avenue to do that. So yeah, I mean, they just, it needs to be a complete rethink, I think, you know. And since I've kind of been back at work, I've tried to do a lot more stories on mental health, and that's helped me in terms of feeling like I've got a sort of a renewed purpose since it all happened, and I kind of use my experience for good in a way. But it, from the work I've done on it, it just shows that it's just severely lacking.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's cool that, I guess, you've now, it's quite fitting that you've got a job that is allowing you to kind of to pursue that stuff. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that something you feel has been important in your sort of recovery?
Yeah, it has. Feeling like, I think it goes back to that kind of identity and purpose that we mentioned before, and trying to be almost like a spin doctor in a way, and spin this story, my story, sounds a bit cheesy, but to use it for good, whether that be doing this or using my job as a journalist to highlight the failures of the system and bring about change, I think is good, selfishly for my own recovery, but also for, you know, wider context.
Totally.
Obviously, we've mentioned the your role in sort of covering the Manchester attacks and how that affected you, and the sort of idea of po- post-traumatic and the sort of trauma and how we deal with it.
Yeah.
That's clearly been a big thing in your...
Yeah, I think so. And when I reflect back, you know, and properly acknowledge the fact that I was struggling for a number of years, and like we said, throwing myself into work, I look at past traumas and think, well, I never really dealt with that properly at the time. Whether that be, you know, I lost my granddad and a very close-knit family. I lost my granddad in 2014. It was quite sort of a long and sort of horrible death. And I am seeing someone die in front of you. And then as a family, never really processing that afterwards. Yeah, that. And then I think of, I see me falling out with my friends and the way my sexuality came out as a trauma as well. So I know that, you know, people, some people who would have gone through, I would say, a traditional trauma, whether that be, you know, being attacked or a car crash or, you know, or going back to the war zone thing, but would say, oh, well, but I see trauma comes in all shapes and sizes.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people's mental health always has some underlying trauma that they haven't properly processed.
So it's the idea that people go through a trauma and a lot of the time will think, this isn't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
You know, and especially because we've sort of fed this narrative of trauma has to be something huge. And if you're struggling with this thing, then you're being weak.
Exactly. Mm. And I think you need to almost nip it in the bud when it happens. Otherwise, it is just left to fester and becomes this whole bigger problem just waiting to erupt, and like it did for me after Manchester. So yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for people getting the help they need after a specific thing happens rather than let it eat away at them.
Yeah, and I guess then a big part of that also comes down to education and acknowledgement that trauma is a broad umbrella term and that it can apply to so many things. Like big events in your life, happenings can be traumatic and can be traumas, and I think that we wouldn't think of them necessarily as being traumas and therefore wouldn't necessarily think of them as having an impact on us unless it had been a death, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are loads. I mean, you mentioned, well, your parents being divorced, that's probably had more of an impact than you had.
And I thought, yeah, I mean, my parents got divorced, well, not actually technically divorced, they were separated for a while, but they split up when I was about 8-9 years old, and then we moved away from my dad as well, a few hundred miles away from Scotland into the Midlands in England, and I never really thought, so I was too young at the time to think, this is going to affect me later in life, but I've got obsessive compulsive disorder, and every therapist that I've seen said you lost control of your life in that scenario, so you started trying to control everything else.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I don't know how I could have nipped it in the bud at 9-10 years old, but
I suppose almost it's not about sort of nipping the actual trauma in the bud. You mentioned education, Paddy, and like it's building that emotional kind of resilience early on and equipping you, whether that be through your parents or through schools or something, someone equipping you with the tools to be able to deal with what life throws at you.
Yeah, totally. And I guess, as is the ongoing challenge, I also love Will's just clicked on his phone and the alert that's come up says don't think about it, which is so perfect. Tell us a bit about that very quickly as a little aside, Will.
My problems with anxiety just come with like ruminations over all sorts of things. So yeah, I just decided one day to put a reminder on my phone every hour that just says don't think about it. So whatever it is.
It's good.
It's certainly broad.
It's weird, but it's good.
So it comes up all the time.
So nice. You have your own little kind of quirks and ways of dealing with things.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I've sort of, it's got getting to recovery, it's all about kind of self-care as well and that role of it. So, you know, exercise, you know, I have to sweat and run and get it out of my system. That helps me massively, and everyone has their own little quirks like that.
Yeah.
I don't exercise.
Just set reminders.
Don't need to with that. Yeah. Just don't think about it.
Simple.
cured.
I can't remember where we were at, but I think that Will's Don't Think About It was a just made me think, well, maybe just don't think about it. Don't think about where we're at. I'm not sure where we're at, but I'm sure it was a good place. So, Jamie, I think, so just to finish off, I think we try and ask most of our guests this. What would be your advice to an 18-year-old, 17, 16-year-old Jamie prior to all this going on, looking back with what you know now?
Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? I would talk to people. I would be more direct in the way I dealt with things and confront things head on. I think too many people kind of beat around the bush when it comes to mental health and things that are bubbling away, like it was for me. And I think just being direct and acknowledging it and confronting it will do the world of good. So I think being far more, if for me, I would be far more honest and open with family and friends. I would be far more honest about my struggles with sexuality. And I would just sort of care for myself a little better.
And just to finish on that point, because you talk about be far more open about your sexuality, much more, like all of these things, much easier said than done. What would have helped you, aged late teens, to be far more open about your sexuality?
Positive role model.
Yeah.
It's someone you can relate to. And I think this is what why I wanted to do this today is, you know, these, if people listen to this, you know, I was debating at one point on the other night whether to do it. And my friend James said, do it because you never know, you could even save one life by someone listening to your story and then relating to it.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought, fuck it, let's do it.
Yeah.
So it's all about being able to relate to someone and seeing that you're not so isolated as you perhaps feel.
Yeah, well, we're very grateful that you have come on. I think let's just finish off with another cliche. I think that generally people people don't really regret the risks they do take. They sort of regret the risks they don't. Yeah. And so I think we felt very nervous about starting this podcast and being very open, but the response has been overwhelmingly positive, and I'm sure it will be to yours too. So thank you so much for coming on, Jamie. You've been a star.